I'm an ALC missionary and currently serving in Bogota in Colombia, and stationed right now in the city of Bogota, which is the capital of Colombia. We've been there 5 years, and we're on furlough right now, which they used to call furlough. We're forbidden to use that word anymore. We now call it home leave. Furlough is what soldiers have. Home leave is what missionaries have. So we're on home leave, and that's a 2-month period of time for us, particularly this time, because the mission department now sends people out on 33 months overseas, 3 months home, or 22 months overseas and 2 months home, whichever of those one might choose. So we're just finishing up our 2-month home leave this time, and we go back to Colombia in about a week, for 22 more months at least. When I talked to Walt about some of the things that we might share, one of the things I thought was very interesting is what the church is like in Latin America. Because it's, as I said last night, that the Christian community in Latin America is heavily influenced by North American, you know, religious groups of all kinds. And it has its own particular past, and we have very limited work as Lutherans in Latin America. The American Lutheran Church has a working relationship with the Mexican Church, which is very limited, and the Mexican Church is very small. We have a relationship with the Colombian Church and with the Brazilian Church. Far and away, the largest of these three churches that we relate to is the Brazilian Church, because it's an immigrant church still. Most of the Lutherans in Brazil are almost 1 million people there who are Lutheran. Almost all of them are German, of German descent. Many of them are still German nationals. And in Brazil, it was only in the last 5 years that they began to use Portuguese in their worship services rather than German. They had been using German right up until about 1970, 72 in that era. When we talk about the church in Latin America, and I deliberately said the church in Latin America, we're talking about the Roman Catholic Church. Because I'm sure most of you know the statistics, well over 90% of all the people in Latin America are at least on paper Roman Catholics and baptized Roman Catholics. There are some statistics that I find interesting and maybe you don't know about, I didn't know about them. For example, more than one-third of all Roman Catholics live in Latin America. That's a big chunk of the largest Christian community in the world. I never realized that. The largest Roman Catholic population of any country in the world is Brazil. Brazil is a very large country, for those of you who don't know. I forget the population right now. It's over 100 million, something like 120 million. And of course, 95% of them are Roman Catholics. The Catholic Church in Latin America has received about... Here's a chair here if you'd like to come in. The Catholic Church in Latin America has received about as much attention relative to the whole body of Roman Catholicism as has Latin America in the whole world scene. That is to say, very little. The Roman Catholic Church can be characterized in almost all of Latin America as still a church which is controlled by Europeans. In Venezuela, 60% of the priests are from Spain, Italy, or France. There are a few from North America too. In Colombia, it's a smaller percentage, like about 40. But in all Latin American countries, a large portion of the day-to-day ministry is done by foreigners, many of whom never nationalize but simply live for a number of years in Latin America. So perhaps we could say generously that there are 5% of the people that live in Latin America who are actively involved in non-Roman Catholic churches. It's very difficult to break this down, because keeping statistics is not a value among Latin American people. They don't feel it's important to count noses as much as we do, and they don't turn in reports. Many of the Protestant people in Colombia, for example, where I live, are very frustrated by this. These are the people who have been educated by North Americans. They're very frustrated by the fact that they can't keep statistics. And they keep going to their churches and going to their pastors and begging them to at least every couple of years give an average round number kind of figure, but it's impossible to determine. The best guesses, for example, in Colombia, which is the most conservative Roman Catholic country in all of Latin America, the best guesses are that around 500,000 people are actively involved, not necessarily members, but actively involved in non-Roman Catholic churches out of a population of 25 million. So that's about 2%. of the population that's involved with other groups than Roman Catholics. The other of the other groups, then, the largest group is far and away Pentecostally oriented churches, not necessarily Assemblies of God, although Assemblies of God is very big in Latin America, Church of God is too, but many, many small groups which splintered off in those countries, which may be the most healthy movement, the most healthy part of the Pentecostal movement in Latin America, because they're uniquely Latin American. For example, a good friend of mine in Bogota is the founder of his own church, which now numbers around 8,000 people. He was in an Inter-American mission, which was sort of Methodist-oriented, Free Methodist-oriented, back in the 50s, and received what he calls the baptism of the Holy Spirit, and after that time then was not allowed to function in that church because they did not accept that doctrine, and so he formed his own group, which now is a very large group. So most of the non-Catholic people are Pentecostal or oriented toward Pentecostalism, or what we might even call charismatics. Many of the people, the richer people, are quite frequently involved in charismatic movement of one type or another in Latin America. So that's kind of an overview of what the numbers situation is. The church within each country is, and speaking of the Roman Catholic Church, the others as well, but the church within each country is very, very different. For example, in Mexico, after the Mexican Revolution of 1811, I think it was, if I'm not wrong, well, the early 1800s, the church was made illegal by the state, and all of their property was confiscated, and priests were forbidden to walk around the streets with collars on and all the rest. This is kind of interesting, since the leaders of the revolution were Roman Catholic priests, Spanish-born Roman Catholic priests. So the church in Mexico now functions in a sort of a tolerance policy. I grew up I spent part of my high school years in Seattle, and I remember at that time they had what they called a tolerance policy about certain kinds of things. I think there were peg boards and other games they used to play in bars, and it was technically in the state of Washington, it was illegal to have games of chance in public places, but they had a tolerance policy. The police put up with it, and they sort of kept it under control. That's the state of the Roman Catholic Church in Mexico. They have a tolerance policy, the government does, toward the church. Technically, legally, the church doesn't own any property in Mexico at all. It's all owned by the state. They took it over after the revolution. But practically speaking, the church manages its own properties and does pretty much the same things it does in other countries. And the presidents of Mexico have always been members of, what's the big men's organization? Knights of Columbus, isn't it? Mm-hmm. They've always been members of the Knights of Columbus. And so the church still has a great deal of influence even in Mexico. In other countries, the church is ignored. Some of the smaller countries in Latin America, some of the Caribbean areas, the Roman Catholic Church has practically given them up as lost, although the people still will come to a mass if a priest comes and visits. In Brazil, the Roman Catholic Church has become very active politically in certain parts, as you may know. Dom Elder Câmara is a Brazilian bishop who has made a name for himself because he was in Recife, where the conditions among poor people are just unbelievable, even for Latin America. And so he became interested in fighting for a new kind of life for the people who were trapped in this city situation. And he gained a real name for himself in that respect. Also, the base communities, comunidades de base, which is a new thing in Roman Catholicism that was blessed by Pope Paul VI, was something really that began in Brazil. So Brazil has sort of forward-moving, alive Roman Catholic community, what we might even say is more spiritually alive than many Roman Catholic churches, even, for example, the United States. It's a very exciting kind of thing, and since Brazil is so large, they have a majority of the bishops in the Latin American Conference of Bishops, so they've had a big say in what's going on. In 1968, a Conference of Bishops was held in Medellin in Colombia, and they came out with some really, for that time, dramatic statements about liberation theology and how the church needed to concentrate on the kind of living conditions in which most of its people live. And there was a great deal of uproar about that, and it was all brought about by the Brazilian bishops. There were a few other bishops from other countries that were involved too, but the Brazilians were the ones really that spearheaded it, that wrote all the position papers and brought them in and did the politics necessary to get them passed. You may have heard that now in Puebla, in Mexico, when they had their delayed second conference of CELAM, the Latin American Bishops Conference, and Pope John Paul II visited, there was a sort of a moderating thing. And the chairman of CELAM is an archbishop from Colombia, very conservative man, and they're trying to kind of take the rough edges off of a lot of things that were said in Medellin. Colombia is one of three countries in the world that have what's called Concordat with Rome. Italy, Spain, and Colombia are the only three countries in the world that have an official arrangement with Rome where the Vatican has a representative that sits in our government, or various representatives that sit in our government in Colombia, and have a lot of say in so far as what goes on there, so far as education, religious education, and public schools and all the rest. So that gives you an idea of kind of where it's at in Colombia. What we have experienced in the past few years in looking at the religious situation in Colombia, in our country where we live now, is that there has been a great rash of small groups of Americans who have, whether they've gone there and organized or organized here first and sent people down to Colombia, there have been all kinds of groups that have organized, and now we have 200 non-Roman Catholic groups operating, vying for the attention of these 500,000 people in Colombia, who are actively involved in non-Roman Catholic communities. The majority of these small groups are Pentecostally oriented, or they've come out of the Jesus movement. There are a lot of people who call themselves faith missionaries. I kind of think we're all faith missionaries, but what they mean by faith missionary is that there is no national organization which backs them up, should they be unable to raise their own support. Alfa Omega is real big in Colombia. That's Campus Crusade for Christ, translated into Spanish. Also, InterVarsity does some work there, although not too much. Campus Crusade has been in a great deal of trouble in the last few years, especially because they work with university students and they have been unwilling to take a stand as to whether they are Roman Catholic or Protestant. And of course, we know them here as a Protestant movement. But they refuse to identify themselves as Protestants in Latin America because they feel it shuts too many doors for them. They wouldn't be able to work with a lot of university people and a lot of Roman Catholics. There's been some deception, I'm afraid, and some of that has been discovered, and that's one of the reasons the government is now considering the possibility of taking away their legal personage, which means they would have to leave the country. The Campus Crusade people raise their own support by individuals and churches and so on in the United States, and they get their salary guaranteed before they go overseas. They are trying to follow the same mode, and this is one of the things that helps us understand better the cultural differences. They're trying to follow the same mode in Colombia and in all of the world that they do in the United States. That is, that any worker or any Christian who wants to become a worker with Campus Crusade has got to round up his own support first. In Colombia, that's very difficult. Because here, where you might deal with somebody who does have an extra $10 or $50 or $100 in a year to contribute toward the support of somebody that they feel is doing a real positive work, in Colombia you might find a whole bunch of people who have an extra 50 cents a year or an extra dollar a year. And it's become very difficult for them to raise their support. And many of the people in Campus Crusade who are nationals, Colombians, are saying, why can't a person raise that support in the United States and let us be the beneficiaries of that support, since the United States is where the money is anyway. And Campus Crusade is having some real problems over that because their national workers aren't able to come up with their support, and so they don't have as many workers, they don't have the kind of multiplication that takes place here. The Pentecostal churches, being the largest in number, have a great deal of influence on the other Protestant communities in Latin America, and if you were to go to worship at a Presbyterian church, for example, in a little town not far from where we live, you would not recognize it at all as Presbyterian, unless I told you it was. They raise their hands in prayer. There's a lot of amens and hallelujahs. People do speaking in tongues. There's all that kind of thing very, very present in other of the mainline churches, which we wouldn't think would do that kind of thing. There are two influences, I think, for the non-Roman Catholic community. One is a Pentecostal influence, and the other is a sort of a holiness kind of influence that comes out of the kind of Methodist background. That is to say, identifying the seven deadly sins as smoking, drinking, dancing, wearing lipstick, going to movies, and so on. The idea that one must strive to lead a purified life, and that this is what it means to be a Christian. That kind of influence is very strong, and the Pentecostal influence is very strong. So to find a church that might look something like a Baptist church or a Lutheran church or a Presbyterian or Methodist church in the United States in that culture simply is impossible. Our Lutheran church, unfortunately for it, in Colombia, has sort of been able to stay away from some of these kinds of influences. And what we have is just a whole lot of really dead liturgical worship services, which turns people off in droves, and for that reason the Lutheran community is shrinking year by year, inevitably getting smaller. We talk a great deal in the church about the need to do evangelism and so on, but quite frankly, and especially after listening to Walt this morning, I've been confirmed once again in my thinking that because there is no viable community in any of our churches, and that's a horrible thing to say in that way, in such a stark way, and you probably think I'm being overly dramatic, but it's true. In none of our churches do we have a true community or any semblance of it. Because of that, they're not attractive to people. And many of the people who are in them want out of them. And especially young people, now we have some second generation Lutherans because we've been working in Colombia since 1936. So now we have some children of Lutheran parents, and they just stay away in droves. They don't want to have anything to do with the Lutheran church. If they want to get excited about Jesus Christ and his part in their life, they go to other places to find their nourishment and their community, because in our church we don't have community. One of the things that works very much against the kind of community that I think is necessary to have evangelism in Colombia is the strong family influence. Another is the Roman Catholic background of most of our church members. First, let me say something about the strong family influence. It's wonderful to see the way the family operates in Latin America. It really is. It's a very positive kind of thing. People tend to hold together in spite of everything. People do not relate to the family situation, let's say, that Mary and I have, because our families are sort of fragmented and we really don't have very much in common anymore, and we hardly even get together. And the people who we are closest to are not family members. They can't understand that, because for them the family is the family is the family, in spite of what it may look like and how it may act. In the Christian community, then, that becomes a negative kind of influence, because what you have when you get 100 people together are 10 families who do not relate to each other. And what I care about are the people in this room. I couldn't care if everyone out there falls down and dies of hunger as long as we're all right in here. And that's very much what happens in all of our communities, even in the Pentecostal community, although there an effort is made, at least in the surface way, to encourage interrelation between families and interdependence, and show people that we need one another in order to function as Christian people. The other bad influence that we have is the Roman Catholic background of most of our people. Roman Catholicism has been very much consumer-oriented in all of its history, let's say since the 14th century, and especially so in Latin America. It still hangs on. We live in a pre-Vatican II kind of situation. The Roman Catholic idea of the sacrifice of the Mass is part of that. The idea that, or their theology of the sacrifice of the Mass, that is that what matters is that the priest is consecrating the elements and he communes. Beyond that, everyone else is a spectator, and the idea of participation is non-existent. It's simply that you go to see that this is still happening, and if you're in shape, you can commune, or if you want to, you can participate, but you don't have to. And all you have to do is give what we call limosnas, little monies, to the poor people on the streets, and attend Mass on more or less, and you've kind of done your Christian obligation. The priest takes care of the rest of the religious life for you. That naturally carries over into our churches, because these people were all Roman Catholics before. So it makes it difficult to establish community that way too, because they simply are not accustomed even to having a coffee hour after church, even to standing around and talking with anyone. We did that in the parish where we were in San Lucas. It's a very American thing to do, I suppose, although having coffee together is a very Colombian thing to do. And so we'd stand around after worship and have some coffee, and it was inevitably the same thing. Here was the Lopez family, here was the Gomez family, you know. And those of us, there were a few guys that I was working with at that time that didn't have real close family ties and would like to have had a family there at the church, and they felt just locked out. And I'm afraid that's the way the church has been, is, and if it continues that way, we'll cease to exist. I think in order just to maintain what we have, we've got to be able to break through the kind of heavy family structure and make people aware that other people matter too, not just your brothers, sisters, uncles, cousins, and all the rest.
How do the Mormons do down there? Because they're so family-oriented.
They just fit right in, as you can well imagine. Not only because they're family-oriented, that's the number one thing, but they also produce a kind of a straightened-out, very rigid, clean living. That because of the kind of situation we live in, you know, every Latin man has two or three Latin women. Some of them, with some of them he has children, with others he doesn't. Most of the time he has children, and that's forbidden. And he drinks, he smokes, all of those things are forbidden. He lies, he steals, he cheats, those things are forbidden. And so, especially women in Latin America are really excited about getting their family into the Mormon church, because then it'll straighten all this stuff out for them. And it has done that, you know.
Provides rules to live by.
Absolutely, it produces. Mormons are now one of the biggest groups after working 12 years in Colombia. Nobody knows for sure, once again. But we're fairly certain there are more than 10,000 and probably not 15,000. So between 10 and 15,000 Mormons after 12 years of their missionary activity in Colombia. And the Lutherans after 40 years have 1,500. And I don't say that to condemn either group, but simply to show you that it is possible if you have something that's working for people, something that they're interested in, and something that they can vibrate with, that you can have all kinds of followers, even though you're North American. And that's the strange thing, because the North Americans are very much looked down upon in Latin America. And these people are so obviously North American. You know, like I told some friends this morning, they all look like they had the same mother. You know, they all wear brown suits and white shirts and green ties, and they have a little name tag here, and blonde hair cut short and glasses, and they walk around with their little briefcases, and everybody in Colombia just snickers, you know, and they know who they are. And of course, when they start talking to people, right away after the first 15 or 20 minutes, they have to talk about Jose Smith. And Jose Smith is a gringo, you know, Joseph Smith. And how can they talk to people and tell them that now what we're going to do is follow a gringo, when people are very much down on gringos, you know? So they've been able, with all of these things going against them, they still have a community that's 10 times bigger than we have. And even bigger than many of the Pentecostal groups, which have been working equally hard and for 20 or 30 years and had some pretty spectacular growth. So there must be some things there that connect. And one of them is the family. Because, as you say, it's a very family-oriented group. And that has just fit right in with the Roman Catholic, or with the Latin emphasis on the family and its value. I want to say something about how relations are between churches, and it's very similar in almost all Latin American countries, although we're way behind in Colombia from what some people are. Those of you who can remember back, when I was a little kid growing up in St. Cloud, Minnesota, in 1945-46, St. Cloud was a Catholic town. Maybe it still is, I don't know. But St. Cloud was a Catholic town. My brother and sister were stoned because they were Lutherans going to school there. And my mother told me when I got older that when we lived in, was it in Litchfield? Maybe it was in Litchfield. That she had four or five Catholic neighbors, and that they would all come out and say nasty things to her on Sunday morning as she was leaving for church, because it happened that Mass was earlier, and they had all come home and they were on their porches, and when she went to Mass, they would say rotten things to her. Now, this was only 40 years ago. You know, that's not very long ago, and that's where we were then. That's where Colombia is now. There's still those kinds of things going on. There was a period of violence which started with the killing of a real hero, a political hero, in 1948, commenced a time of violence, and the Roman Catholic Church decided to aprovechar, as I said last night, take advantage of an opportunity to wipe out these pesky Protestants all at the same time, because it was a conservative-liberal kind of fight between the two major parties in Colombia, the conservative and the liberal party, and of course most Protestants were members of the liberal party, because the liberal party wanted to end the Concordat with Rome wanted to wipe out the religious training in public schools and all the rest. And naturally, then the Protestants were with them, and the Roman Catholics were very much against that. The strong ones were in the Conservative Party. So as the violence began, the Roman Catholic Church officially, and there's documentation to prove it, decided this was an opportune moment to wipe out the Protestants through harassment, through murder, through deception, through all kinds of things. The Lutheran Church had 5 churches burned down at this time, 3 pastors murdered, and who knows how many lay people were murdered during these 10 years of violence, so from 1948 to 1958. So during that time then, the Protestant community, the non-Catholic community, came together under this kind of persecution, formed what was known as a confederation of evangelical churches. Everything that's not Catholic in Latin America is called evangelical. The Mormons are called evangelicals. The Jehovah's Witnesses are called evangelicals. Everyone's an evangelical, not a Roman Catholic. The evangelicals, but not the Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses at that time because they weren't there, got together then and formed a kind of a national council of churches, which functioned as an information center and a helping center to where to move to, where was it better, where was it worse, where can we be of help, and these kinds of things. It was formed then in antipathy, no, in contra, against the Roman Catholic community. This organization still exists today, but it's much weakened since the time of the violence ended, and Vatican II changes have just now begun to take effect in Colombia. And as one of my Colombian friends, who's a pastor in our church there, told me, he said, you know, Vatican II is really a trick by the Roman Catholic Church to undermine the Protestant movement in Latin America. That's why they called Vatican II Council together, was to undermine the Protestant movement in Latin America. I was so astounded by what he had said, I repeated this back to him. I said, do you mean to say, and he said, yes, that's exactly what I mean. That was part of their scheming and organizing to do this, so that and now look, they've gone and even tricked the people by giving them Bibles. They've tricked them by having Bible studies, and they've tricked them into thinking that they're open and that they're wanting to change and all that. That's how conniving they can be. They'll even use the Bible as a tool to trick people. You can see what the Lutheran attitude is toward Roman Catholics. This Protestant group then looks at the Roman Catholic community as católicos, no? They're Catholics. They're not Christians. We are Christians, they are Catholics. They do not in any way, shape, or form consider Catholics as part of the Christian community. They are idolaters. They are worshippers of Mary. And they have no business thinking of themselves as Christians. And what we need to do really is to get everybody converted out of the Roman Catholic Church and into the Protestant communities. And they seriously believe that, even though there are 24.5 million Roman Catholics and 500,000 Protestants. So ecumenical relations, needless to say, don't exist, because why would you want to have any kind of a relationship with a group of people that aren't Christian? You know, you might as well get a bunch of Marxists together or a bunch of Hindus or something like that and have friendships with them. So the church is at that point, and only now in the last 5 or 6 years has there been any kind of inter-Protestant community in knowing what is going on in the Roman Catholic community. There are now some Protestants who will consider that there might possibly be some Catholics who are Christians, possibly. Not a lot, but some. And there are some Roman Catholics now who are considering the possibility that within all of these pesky people, Americans, most of them, or American-influenced people, there may be some people who are really serious about their Christianity, and that we maybe are all in the same family. So what we're doing now, as part of what I plan to do in these next 2 years, is work in that area. Because I think as we look at Latin America, we've got to be realistic that we are not going to convert Roman Catholic people to Protestantism, even though fallen away ones, and it's silly to even think about that. In the second place, the Roman Catholic Church has all the things necessary, were it to really come alive, to reform socially, politically, economically, and spiritually all of Latin America in one fell swoop. They have enormous power. Still, even though people will say, spit on priests and all of the rest, still and all, when it comes time for the marriage or the funeral or the baptism or the illness or whatever it may be, that's their church, that's their community. And so I think that that what we should start looking at now, and I say this as a missionary, and this is what I'm trying to inject as part of our policy in our Division for World Mission, what we need to start thinking about is how can we help the Roman Catholic community to become a renewed community so that they can speak to the political, social, economic, and spiritual needs of the people in Latin America, all of whom almost are members of their community. And I think that there are some openings, and that should we decide that as a missionary outreach, we want to help the Roman Catholic community in this way, and should they decide that they would like this kind of help, I think we could do some fantastic mission work in Latin America. And I think that there are some openings, and that should we decide that as a missionary outreach, we want to help the Roman Catholic community in this way, and should they decide, I think we could do some fantastic mission work in Latin America. I think to say something on the positive side of the Protestant influence in the last 150 years, when more or less there's been a great deal of mission activity in South America, there had been in Central America before that, but not much in South America, in the last 150 years, there are some things I think that have happened partly as a result of Protestant influence. For example, the whole business of Bible study, reading Bibles, being more involved in community life within churches and stuff, is all brand new for Roman Catholics there, and I think part of the seeds of that were sown by the Protestant movement in Latin America. Then it was kind of culminated with Vatican II and a lot of the declarations that were made there, and people suddenly began to open their eyes. So I think we have done something. It's been very costly in dollar terms, and it is very costly. And you know, I'm not an administrator, and I don't think we can measure Christianity in terms of dollars and cents. But when you stop to think that we are spending, the American Lutheran Church alone is spending $165,000 in 1979 in Colombia, and that there are 1,500 people there in our community, that works out to a pretty large piece of money per capita. And I simply think that we have to ask some questions if you can justify doing that kind of thing. I think there are lots of options. I think that, I didn't mean to talk missionary, but I'll talk missionary for just a couple of minutes, and then I want to hear what you have to say. I think there are a couple of options. For example, one of the insinuations I've made to our division people, which they haven't cared for, is this. It costs $20,000 a year to support a missionary family overseas. Salary, pension, home leave costs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So education for the children and so on. About $20,000 a year for one family. And generally, the family with small children, and so the wife can't be actively involved in church affairs and so on, and it's not possible because of the setup we live in, either the security problems and so on. So really, you get one person for $20,000. We could have six Colombians for $20,000. See? To me, that's a very, very clear kind of thing. However, we are not in the habit in world missions of giving money without strings. And maybe if you took Roy Seeger out of there and put six Colombians in there, maybe two of them would abscond with money, and maybe two more wouldn't do much, and maybe you'd only end up with two. But I still say two is better than one, and probably five times better, because I'm an American after all. Mm-hmm. And as I tried to say last night, and I didn't say it clearly enough, I cannot, and I struggle with it, and I worry about it, and I think about it, and I pray about it, and I talk with my community about it. I cannot, no matter how much I try, separate myself from all that I know in this country and how I've been brought up and all the rest. I cannot really relate at the deepest level to that person in Latin America who wants to become a Christian and asks me how it's to be done, or the man who I confront on the street. I just can't do that. What happens is, and we've got evidence of it in our 1,500 people, is they become Americanized. And that really doesn't do them any good. I mean, it does from one standpoint, because they end up with more money, they end up going to all meetings on time, you know, but I just don't think that's what needs to be done for them and with them. And so I think there are some things that we better start thinking about. And some people have been kind of upset. They say, well, you think we should get out of world missions? No, I don't think we should get out of world missions. I think we just better start doing it in a new way and right away. We've just fiddled around in this way for way too long. So those are some of the things that I think we ought to do, and that's why I'm going to start now working. I've got a really good contact in the Roman Catholic Church, a young priest named Rolando Bueno. He's a good friend of mine, and he has studied in the exterior. He studied in Strasbourg at the Ecumenical Institute. He was at Tessé in France, which is an ecumenical monastery, and he's really got some good things going, and so between us, with our youth groups, we have already had retreats and meetings and get-togethers and all the rest, and my young people, some of whom are Roman Catholic, but most of whom are second-generation Lutherans now, say, wow, you know, these guys aren't nearly as bad as I thought they were. They're very much like us, and all of the kinds of wow kinds of things that we discovered maybe 15 or 20 years ago here. So I think that's the direction, definitely I'm going with my ministry, and I think that's the direction we have to go as Lutherans in Colombia. And I think the church has to kind of find its own way. But it's a very difficult situation, and until people are willing to begin to consider each other as Christian people, our church isn't going to do anything. And perhaps, and you're going to say this is awful, but perhaps it's better that it died if it's not going to really begin to take seriously what the body of Christ is all about. These are my brothers. I don't care if they're wrong. I don't care if they're idolaters. I don't care if they're Mary worshippers. They're still my brothers. I believe in baptism. I believe in the sacraments. And somehow, if they're doing all these things that are bad, I've got to help them so they quit doing them and do some different things. And I think if the Lutheran community would begin to operate in that way in Latin America, we'd have a whole new ballgame. So anyway, that's kind of where the church is at, and maybe you've got some
How much direction do you get when you're sent? I mean, you know, because obviously you have to have the person who would understand it most would be you. And they must give you an awfully free rein, don't they? I mean,
the direction comes from the national church. I think there are only about two quotes missions left in the ALC. One is in to the Fulani people in Africa. That's a mission. The others are all national churches to which we relate through written contracts and all the rest.
See.
So, the Colombian church said we want to have a guy who does this, this, and this. So the ALC said, "Do you want to go down and answer that?" And I did. And so I work for the Colombian National Church, and I have to take direction from them. Sometimes that's really good. Sometimes I don't like it at all. I would say, generally speaking, we have a very good president right now. He's a friend of mine. And we're kind of on the same wavelength, although there are plenty of points at which we differ. But he knows how to be a good pastor, and he's been a good pastor to me. And I operate very much as a pastor does with his church council, really. I take orders from them, and yet I try to help them see some things that need to be done and things like that. Yeah.
How many people from America are down there right now?
In our group right now, we have five missionaries. Yeah. There's Phil Anderson, son of Vernon Anderson, Northern Wisconsin District President. Phil is doing a radical thing in a little town that I don't have time to tell you about. It's all very exciting. He was in the Peace Corps for 2 years, and he's got a nice background. He was also in Mexico before. Phil Anderson and Gerhard Cartford, who is a musician, taught at TLC for like 17 years, taught at Luther Seminary for a while, and now is there doing some music and worship stuff. We work very closely together. A young fellow named Mark Wilms, who is a radio announcer and somewhat expert in communications, to direct, and here's one of the most frightening things in all the world. We, through UMA monies, they put together a $500,000 communications program for our 1,500 people, or to convert all the other 25 million, maybe. But they just, I mean, they've already said the number, and everybody knows it, that there are $500,000 earmarked, and they're going to spend every nickel of it. It's a very frightening kind of prospect. So far, we've been able to keep the lid on. Mark is trying to work with that. There's a guy named Victor Pavasars, Viestris Pavasars. He's a Latvian-American who has been there like 15 years. And us. Yeah. And I'm in youth and evangelism now. They named me National Youth Director. There's no youth department, and there's no office or anything. National Evangelism Director. There's no program office or department. And I direct the follow-up part of this horrible communications program that we're going to get into. We are into.
What is being done in the way of seminary training for natives?
The seminary training has progressed this way. The first leaders that were sent to seminary were sent to Buenos Aires, to Concordia Seminary, Missouri Synod, operated in early 1950s. Came away with Missouri Synod theology of about 1930. Bad enough in 1979, 1930, and they still operate with that. The next wave of leaders was sent to Mexico, where we have a combined seminary with Methodists and Episcopalians and a few others in Mexico City, Seminario Augsburgo, which was also dominated by Missouri Synod theologians. most of whom were pretty open guys, and but they had a kind of a mixed experience. And now the church, the national church on its own, because we've kept out of it, has decided that they're going to educate their seminarians at a Baptist seminary in Columbia. So we will now have Baptist pastors.
Baptist Lutherans.
Baptist Lutherans, yeah. And that's a great concern to us, huh?
Why is it... Well, I might have missed something by coming late.
No, I don't think so.
Why is it that the church... Why are they asking you to come? I mean, why... You know, aren't there enough people that they can get a hold of in their own setting?
Okay.
You know, because you mentioned the higher six Colombians.
Right. There are people, but there's a whole bunch of factors. Let me just tick a few off. There was the first Colombian president of the Colombian church, when we got rid of the gringos as presidents of the church, started in 1967. And his idea was to get rid of every gringo in the world. He couldn't stand them. But at the same time, he felt that none of the young people in the church who came to the church and said, I would like to become a pastor, was eligible. So for 10 years, no one was educated theologically. Zero. Because none of these people lived up to his standards. Right? So that's one factor. Another factor is that the Colombian church loves missionaries for two reasons. One is you don't have to pay them. Right? Nothing like having a pastor in your parish that you're not responsible for. You don't have to pay them. Number two, and this isn't boasting at all, we're much better equipped than any Latin American pastor currently serving in Colombia. So if you get a gringo in there, you're liable to get a guy that's not only equipped intellectually and spiritually and stuff, but he'll also probably have an overhead projector and a tape recorder and a 16mm, and he can get his fingers on a lot of things that a Colombian pastor can't, and get money into the parish and all kinds of things. So there hasn't been any real pressure, although the new arrangement that was signed with the Colombian church in 1970 says, in so many words, it is recommended that no North Americans serve in parish pastor capacity. Certainly not alone. But that's been totally ignored. Mm-hmm. Now we're down to two parish pastors out of the five missionaries, and if we're able to carry off our great rebellion, which we're going to organize in October, there won't be any.
How long has the Lutheran Church been in Colombia?
Since 1936.
Mm-hmm. That's longer than in Ecuador.
Yes. Yes, I think Ecuador is World Mission Prayer League and a little bit of LCA. World Mission Prayer League has a much better record than ALC, LCA have in Latin America. And they've done a very startling thing. Let me just say that as long as I thought of it. And they were in Bolivia for quite a number of years and did some fine organizing and this and that. And they had the same problem the Lutheran Church has always had, and it didn't really go anywhere. So Wimple made a decision to cut. And they weren't going to just disappear into the woodwork, but they were going to cut off all funds to the national church, and they were going to pull all of their missionaries out of the parish frontline kind of situations, and they were just going to have a few little people in La Paz. They did that, and the Bolivian church exploded. It is the success story of Latin America as far as Lutherans are concerned. As soon as the gringos got out of there, the thing just came apart. And it's just going like great guns, and thousands of Indian people, most Bolivians are Indian, thousands and thousands of Bolivian people are coming in to the church and coming to know Christ every single year. Now, they're not doing it in what we would call a Lutheran way. They raise their hands and they do all kinds of things, and the men sit on one side and the women sit on the other side, and all kinds of stuff that we probably wouldn't like very much. And they're not very sacramental, I'm afraid. But maybe we have to allow that kind of thing to happen. I don't know.
You mentioned the other night that in Colombia there's kind of a fear of communists.
Yeah.
Are there many or any Colombian Christians who are of a Marxist persuasion that you have encountered?
Yeah, there most certainly are. And as I've told some of my friends, one of the heroes of the Marxist movement in Latin America, there are two heroes, you know, Che Guevara, mm-hmm. and the other one is Camilo Torres, and he was a Colombian. Mm-hmm. And he was a Roman Catholic priest. And most interestingly, as the case with Che and as the case with Fidel Castro, they came from rich families. Camilo was from the Restrepo family, which is one of the big families in Colombia, and it kind of seems to be a pattern. I think that's really interesting. So there was one example. He was more Christian than Marxist, but he bought in a kind of a simplistic way a lot of Marxist stuff that I wouldn't buy. But there was an example, and there are a lot of young people today, I think, who still want to be Roman Catholics and yet want to be politically involved. So.
So who fears the communists?
It's happening. The government primarily, because they stand to lose the most in the rich people. If if the Cuban experiment is any indication, and we don't know much about it in Latin America, what's going on in Cuba, but it appears that they really did wipe out the bourgeois. They just wiped the class right out, apparently. They went to Florida, or they got killed or whatever, and the rich people are afraid of that. If they could do it there, they could do it in Colombia.
So it's not necessarily faithful.
Oh, no, it has...
Right. Right.
I don't think it has anything to do with atheistic communism. I think it has to do with changing the wealth structure, the distribution of wealth. That's what people fear.
To what extent is liberation theology a factor in the church in Colombia?
Not at all. It's looked down upon, laughed at, and all the rest. It's big in the southern cone, Chile, Argentina, Brazil, but in the northern cone, it just don't work. The people are way too conservative for that kind of thinking. And the Protestants are the worst ones, because they say, you know, you stay out of politics altogether. Well, they forget they were in politics between 48 and 58, when during the time of the violence, they were deeply embedded in politics. And they were all going out wearing their red ties, just as red was the liberal color. They would all wear their red ties just to spite the liberals, or the conservatives. So they've been into politics, but now you see that's far removed, and they got hurt too. They don't want to get back into it anymore. So, but the idea of liberation theology is non-existent.
Have you visited a base community?
We had in a Roman Catholic parish right next to ours, and when we were in the parish in Ciudad Kennedy. The priest had organized one, and there were two more coming along. Now they're just being organized. And so we got exposed to some of what they do and how their way, they call it the way, el camino, how it goes and how they study what they do. They start with baptism, and they go right on through. You know, they first learn what their baptism is all about, reaffirm that. But they're much more spiritually organized, oriented in Colombia than they are in Brazil and elsewhere. Now, elsewhere, they're much more politically organized. The idea is to organize, get the community operating, do things. They do some of that, but it comes as a sort of a byproduct rather than a central emphasis. The central emphasis is very much spiritual.
Yeah. Is the strain between the Protestant clergy and the Catholic priests as strong as the lay people?
Yeah, it's worse. Uh-huh. That's where the worst part of it is. And Orlando and I, the priest and I, have in our talk... talking together, have decided that that's the only way, and that's what he told the Cardinal, and the Cardinal was so excited about that he's called me in for a visit when I get back in September. I hope it doesn't come off. I don't know if I could talk to the Cardinal of Colombia or not. He feels that way too, that on both sides it's the hierarchy that's holding things up. Mm-hmm. It's the pastors, and I'm sorry to say this, but in almost every instance in our church in Colombia, what's wrong, the obstacle in the local parish is the pastor. He's the obstacle. Why nothing is happening is because of the pastor.
In America, there's frequently a push for re-education of pastors in some way or another. Is there any possibility of that working in Colombia?
You would go and say that, Marshall. what I said last night about the educational system precludes that, because the pastors there believe that when they graduated from seminary in 1952, they knew everything. And I literally mean everything. They may not have known where India was located on the map and some other incidental things, but they knew everything as far as their background was concerned. And my best friend, the guy who's now the president, he says, you know, he said, I don't know, reading books. He said, I did a lot of that when I was in seminary, but he said, you know, in the last 25 years, I just haven't seen the need for it. And another man prides himself on the fact that he's never even read a daily newspaper. These are the pastors of our churches. So when we talk about continuing education, they just kind of glaze over. They don't know what we're talking about. And we try to do some of it incidentally, even in national conventions and things. And that's when they all say, oh, gee, I've got to go to a meeting. My wife is calling me or something, and the guy ends up with an empty room. It's just not happening. Without leadership, you know, and the statistics are against it, and this is part of what we're putting together as missionaries. Let's say some really horrible things. There are a few of us pastors here today. In the ALC, we have around 5,000 pastors, more or less, right? Okay. To be, as one friend told me, I was being way too generous. To be generous, out of those 5,000, to be quite generous, there are 500 who are really tops, I mean, just the best quality leadership a person could want. That's being overly generous, I realize. But we'll say that, just for the sake of argument. That 10% of our ministerial body in the ALC is really high-quality leadership. And so, with 500 people, boy, you can have a whole bunch in each district, and you can have them in national headquarters, and you can do all kinds of things with 500 really sharp leaders. That's 10%. In Colombia, we had 7 ordained pastors, nationals. Now, 10% of 7 pastors isn't even a whole pastor. So the chances that you're liable to get high-quality, really top-notch leadership don't exist. Now, 3 of those guys, 4 of those guys are retired. Now we have 3 pastors. The chances are even slimmer yet. We've got 5 people coming out of the seminary, and within 4 years, 5 and 3 is 8, we still don't have the necessary base, you see. We're working with so few people. It's just like trying to organize a choir in Holden Village. You can have 2 rehearsals and have a choir that sounds fantastic, unbelievable. You go out to Red Lake Falls, Minnesota, where I served as pastor, and you get a choir of 12 people together that can sing the same note, and I don't mean the same melody line, I mean one note altogether, you've really done something. And we're in that kind of a comparative situation. We just don't have leadership. It's really difficult to pull out leadership when you have such a small group. It's a fight.
I'm curious about the comment you made some time ago about the UMA funding. It sounds suspiciously like UMA at work.
I'm afraid so.
Are they telling you what they want? Is that the idea?
Well,
sort of.
You know, there's a way of getting around that. There is a way of telling people what they want without them knowing that you've told them. And that's what's happened with the communications program in Colombia that's going to cost $500,000. Well, it won't cost that because we won't allow it to be spent.
Before you continue, one other question to add into that. Is that something that you would ask for originally, the National Church, or was that something they thought would be?
Yeah, let me give you the background. Okay. Somebody had said once they had heard about Christ for All the Nations that operates out of Venezuela, Caracas. Steve Huey, a Missouri Synod guy there, really had built a great big empire, and they were broadcasting programs on this. Somebody heard about that. And somebody said, when John Westby, the Area Secretary for World Missions for Latin America, was there, somebody said to him, you know, John, that's really such a neat thing. I think it would be neat if we had a deal like that. You know. So John then went about planting seeds that it might be possible to have a great big huge communications empire and knock the Missouri Synod off the map of Latin America. Right? That's what we're after. And because they had done such a fabulous job, which hasn't produced any results either, if you want to know the truth. It cost them I don't know how many millions of dollars. So he began to plant seeds and say to people, you know, have you ever thought about that? You know, in this community? And pretty soon there were a whole bunch of people who were really interested because it meant, you know, getting some money and you've got to take advantage of any opportunity. So that kind of fell dormant for a while until John came back and revived it again and buttonholed 5 or 6 key leaders in our main church and asked them to put together a program that up to a limit of $500,000 and that it would be funded. They put together a program. The budget worked out, strangely enough, to be an 8-year program. The budget was, strangely enough, $500,000. $500,000 in no sense. Just happened to come out that way. Ducky. And so naturally, as soon as that was presented up here, why, the rubber stamp was there, because you see, it was what we already had decided we wanted to do. And that's what's been going on, frankly, and I'm very angry about it. It's nobody's fault. I don't want to kill John Westby for it. He's not in the World Missions anyway. He's in Fergus Falls now. I don't want to kill Bo Sorensen for it. He's a good man. He's been a friend of mine and good to us as missionaries. But there's a whole kind of attitude like that, and this is what has been going on. And it's got to stop right away.
And also on that debate, when there was possibility on North American Temple, the money was not going
right. That is an interesting touch because the man who had accepted the call to come down and run that program, Roger Dumian, after he got his visa, after a long delay, decided not to do it. He didn't go. And all of a sudden everything was up in the air. We were in crisis. And so John Westby calls up the key leader down there. I happened to be at his house that night. And he says, you know, maybe I've got another possibility. And we had been talking. We had met as a communications committee. They asked me to be on it because I work with youth. And I'd said, well, what do you guys think? They said, well, we know some guys down here in Latin America do this job. And I said, okay, why don't you tell Westby that? So he did. He told him that over the phone. And after Jorge came back and sat down, I said, did you tell him? And he said, yeah. And I said, what did he say? He said, there was a long silence. The $500,000 is contingent upon an American being the one who runs the program.
Okay.
Does that give you a very clear idea of the kind of thinking? And it has to do with our cultural thing, you see. Mm-hmm. These people, they're lazy, they lie, they cheat, they steal, they don't know how to organize, they're inefficient. We can't just give them $500,000. No, I don't think you can either. I don't think pouring money on problems is any kind of solution. But can you trust them with 5,000 or 10 or 50? You know. But as we look at that church, we say, this outfit doesn't even function right by our standards. And so we can't trust them with these kinds of things. So it's the ALC participation in world mission has always been contingent upon personnel. As long as there's a bunch of gringos there to keep tabs on things, they're willing to put money in. When there ain't no gringos, there ain't no money. And that's been made crystal clear. Well, I don't mean to paint a dull picture. I think that it's a real exciting time. And I think we're going to move into doing some new things in terms of world missions, and particularly in Latin America, and especially in Colombia. I think that that's real positive. I mean, I just came back from the West Coast here in Everett and Burlington, where we have supporting congregations, and I painted them a real rosy picture. You know, I mean, I told them the truth, but I painted them a rosy picture of the ministry that I'm doing that they're supporting, because I think we're on the leading edge, and I'm real glad for the kind of support we get here. Not only financial support, but prayer support and things. You know, we'd be dead without the prayer support that we get from this country. A lot of people, sincere people, who really care about missions, and not about doing it in the old style either, who are willing to think about doing it in a new way. I'm just amazed. And I think that our mission executives feel that one of the reasons we don't want to change things so dramatically is because it's so much harder to sell to people. You know, doing something that doesn't produce a church that looks just like the ALC. You can't bring back a picture and say, look, this is what we did. And then the guy doesn't reach in his pocket and pull out a $100 bill. It's so much harder to sell that. But I trust our people in Lutheran Church. And I think that even the hard-nosed ones, and there have been some here who come up to me and said, no, look, I think they can all be educated. And I think we can begin to do our work in a new way. I'm convinced.
I worked on the hunger program a couple of years ago. It was a giving grain kind of thing. And the farmers that came up were willing to give, but their main concern was it got to the people. Eventually.
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. Right. And I have some people now in Everett and Burlington, after hearing the stories of some of the lives that the kids lead in Latin America, are just unbelievable. Children are destroyed starting with day one. And I told them about some of the kids that were trying to help, you know, and right away they said, we want to help. We will give you the money because we trust you and we know that there won't be any middlemen or any cutoffs or anything else, and that all that money will go to help that kid. And they said, and some of the people, one man who offered a great deal of money, said, and I don't care if the kid never becomes a Lutheran or doesn't even become a Christian. I want to help him anyway. That's a brand new attitude. Those kinds of things we can really do. So maybe that's, you know, maybe we have to be facilitators in that way. Don't know.
You're willing to do that.
We're sort of stuck with doing it. It's against mission policy. It's against mission policy, but what can you do?
Of course, it's awfully Christian anyway.
Yeah.
Lose your final authority.
Yeah, the final authority.
But the mission division sort of has a tolerance policy on that too. They know it goes on. And some of it is actually funneled through the ALC. And I want to take away any fears you have. My friend Gay Cartford got, what was it, $1,000, Mary? Yeah, one particular person in Montana, goodness knows how he ever even heard that Gerhard was in Latin America, sent $1,000 to ALC. I said, I want this to go to Gerhard Cartford for his ministry. And he got the money. There it is in his hand. So there is real honesty in the part of the ALC. And the ALC is not afraid to do that. But you can see the kind of situation it creates. If one missionary's got 50 people back there sending 1,000, and another one's only got one, and in all the people you're helping, and so we have to be very discreet about it. I'm giving away all kinds of money there, but nobody has any idea where it comes from. It just suddenly appears. You know, some kid needs to have his foot fixed, and they take him to the hospital, and the bill's already paid. They don't know what happened, but he gets his foot fixed. And so those kinds of things I don't think rob people's responsibility. Like maybe giving money to a family that's poor tends to take away their responsibility. But there are ways of doing it. Yeah, so we're involved in that. Okay, thanks very much. It's been fun.